guess for many of us, thinkable that people in lands like North Korea and Cambodia. And the problem is that in our country, the media don't tell us what's going on, because the people who determine what we see on our television screens are very, very wise, very astute people, and they know what we like to watch on television, and that is, we like to be entertained, and we will look at news that directly affects ourselves and is about people like us. And they know, because they've done all the research on this, that if they put this kind of stuff on television, people don't like it. Some people don't want to know about it. Other people in countries like New Zealand refuse to believe that this is going on in the world. And they know that if they put this stuff on television, fewer people will watch the news. And if there are fewer people watching the news, then they can't get as much money for advertising revenue as they want. And so this sounds like some kind of conspiracy theory. Unfortunately, it's true. And therefore we get told the kind of stuff that people want to see and that will help in the selling of consumer products. And therefore we have no idea what's going on in the world. Unless, of course, something happens that immediately impinges on us, like 450 Afghani refugees end up in a boat that's heading for the coast of Australia, and the Australian government is standing resolute that they will not allow them into Australia, and suddenly, night after night, this is the primary feature on our news, because it directly affects us. And again, what the media doesn't tell us, this 450 refugees from Afghanistan are a tiny, tiny fraction of the 2.5 to 3 million Afghanis who fled from the Taliban, that are an extremist Muslim fanatical group that have run Afghanistan for the last few years, who have killed hundreds of thousands of their fellow Afghani citizens. Nearly 3 million people have fled the country, mostly over the Khyber Pass into Pakistan, where they live in huge refugee camps, and who are desperate, desperate to do anything to get out of this. Most of those who flee have had family members killed, and now our authorities are going to determine which of these people are genuine refugees and which of them are in it for economic reasons. Problem is, we have no idea what the rest of the world is like. I've been doing this series which I've called Life's Deepest Secrets, and it's about the sayings of Jesus, where he tells us, he gives us like an insight onto what life is actually all about, as opposed to the superficial understanding of life that most of us have, that life is about the accumulation of money and consumer products and all this kind of stuff, and we wonder why we're so desperately empty inside. Jesus is telling us what life is really all about. And I was saying last Sunday that Jesus' take on life is actually counterintuitive. The things that you intuitively would think would make us fulfilled and happy in life, Jesus is saying they don't. But of all the things he's saying, this final saying in this series of 8 sayings of his called the Beatitudes, the final one takes the cake, really. Blessed, says Jesus, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, last Sunday night, I was looking at the previous saying of Jesus, where he says that everyone who is a follower of his is called to be a peacemaker. Blessed are the peacemakers, he said, for they will be called the children of God. Now, the problem is that although a follower of Jesus may really seek to make peace between other people and between people and his or herself, not everybody in the world, unfortunately, wants to be at peace with someone who's a follower of Jesus. And persecution is actually the conflict of two totally opposed ideologies. There is no persecution in New Zealand. There is no persecution of Christians in New Zealand. Now, some of you may have become a Christian recently, and you've said to your friends at work what's happened in your life. You've become a Christian, and you may have faced a little bit of sarcasm or even a lot, and some cynicism, but nobody's persecuted in New Zealand. Persecution is when you're put in prison. Persecution is when you're tortured. Persecution is when you're taken out and you face a firing squad for your beliefs. And no one in New Zealand is persecuted for their faith. Now, when you read the New Testament, by comparison, the New Testament is a handbook for the persecuted. Because right from the beginning, when people began to follow Jesus, they experienced persecution. First of all, they had it from the Jews. The Jews were very upset with the followers of Jesus because they believed they were not keeping the traditions of the ancestors. And they were not following the Hebrew scriptures, and so they persecuted them. They put them to death. They tortured them. And then the Christian faith moved out into the Roman society where it was illegal. Because every Roman citizen, once a year, on a special day that was set aside for this, was required to attend the gathering in the major communities in the Roman Empire, where there was a fire that was lit. And every citizen, to prove his or her loyalty to Rome, was required to take a little piece of incense and throw it on the flame, repeating the very simple words, "Caesar is Lord." Now, the Jews refused to do this. But the Jews had been around for hundreds of years, and so they'd been granted an exemption from doing this. But then the Christians began to refuse doing this. But who were they? They weren't Jews, at least most of them weren't, although some of them were. And they were given no exemption from doing this. And so the Romans arrested them. They rounded them up. They rounded them up in huge numbers. And the Christian movement went underground. And they began worshipping Jesus Christ in the catacombs under Rome. And in lots of hidden locations out in forests and in cellars all over the Roman Empire. And the Romans arrested them. They burned them, set them on fire. They fed them to the lions. They were regarded as public entertainment. You went to the Colosseum and you saw the Christians fed to the lions. And this went on for 300 years, three centuries. And here were the followers of Jesus, and they belonged to an illegal, clandestine movement. They worshipped in secret. They couldn't come openly. The Roman authorities raided their gatherings, and they carted them off, put them to death. And during those 300 years, this clandestine underground movement grew and grew and grew. And the hundreds of followers of Jesus became thousands, became tens of thousands, became hundreds of thousands, became millions, until finally, after 300 years, even the emperor bowed the knee and said he would become a follower of Jesus. But when most of us think of persecution these days, we think of it way back there. You go and see movies about Colosseums. And persecution was something that happened way back there. And most of us who live in Western countries like New Zealand, we have no idea that in the last 50 years, since the Second World War, the most astonishing revolution in human history has occurred. Because before the Second World War, if you ask people in the world, what does a Christian look like? It was pretty predictable. Christians largely in the world were white. They were mostly English-speaking. They were Europeans or North Americans. And most people in the world today, when they think of Christianity, that's what they think about. And most people have no idea what's happened in the last 50 years. Because if you ask the question, what does the typical Christian in the world look like today? They don't look like that at all. The typical Christian in the world today is a person of color. They are non-English speakers. They are either from Africa or Asia or Latin America, and they are poor. And in these last 50 years, an astonishing revolution has occurred. And instead of Christianity being the religion of the powerful, the Europeans and the North Americans, today, the face of Christianity has changed so much in the world that the Christian faith has become the religion of the powerless, and the despised, and the forsaken. Today, in China, There are more people worshipping Jesus Christ than in all the countries of Western Europe added together. And this has been in spite of 50 years of some of the most deliberate and targeted persecution in the history of the Christian movement. There are officially government-sanctioned churches in China that would accommodate possibly something like 1 million people or so, I guess, all up. Because the state wants to control Christianity. But there are underground house churches in China numbering, no one knows, tens of millions of people. And in the country that most Western Christians refer to as a mission field, there are today more people worshipping Jesus Christ on this Sunday than there are in the whole of Western Europe put together. And that is how the face of the Christian movement in the world has changed. And the astonishing thing is this, that in those very 50 years where the poor of the earth have become followers of Jesus in unprecedented numbers, the church in the West, in countries like New Zealand, has gone into unbelievable decline. And that's what the media want to tell us. And most often when they show us a church on television, it's a church led by some extremely old member of the clergy and a tiny handful of people sitting in front of them. And no one knows in the West the astonishing revolution that's occurred. Now, if you can answer what the question of why this has happened, no one knows. Why has the church in the Western world so utterly collapsed when we live in affluence, in peace-loving societies, and people have departed the Christian movement in huge, huge numbers? Whereas in the rest of the world, where it is so hard to be a follower of Jesus, where there is so much persecution and so much difficulty, people are becoming followers of Jesus in unprecedented numbers. But this has caused huge problems, because most of the underdeveloped countries in the world are actually run by tyrants. And the growth of this Christian movement is a terrible threat, because if you are a tyrant and you want total control of the country, as we saw in North Korea or in Cambodia under Pol Pot, if you want to control people's minds, you find it intolerable that there are some citizens in the country who owe an allegiance to a higher power than the government. And for tyrants to rule, they must control the minds of men and women. And so the growth of the Christian movement is a terrible threat to them. And that is why today, Sunday, September the 2nd, 2001, it's estimated there are 200 million Christians in the world who face active persecution. There are another 400 million who have legal limitations on the exercise of their faith. That is 600 million followers of Jesus in the world today, to whom Jesus is speaking in these words. There's an American writer named Paul Marshall, who's a sort of an expert on human rights, and he writes, this is his description of Christians in the world today. This is what he says: Christians are African women who rise at dawn to greet the rising sun in a wailing chant of thanks to God. They are Indian untouchables clearing up excrement from the streets. They are slaves in Sudanese markets. They are Chinese peasants flip-flopping by rice fields or pedaling bicycles through Shanghai. They are Mexican tribal people driven from their ancestral homes. They are Filipino maids misused throughout the world. They are Russian Orthodox priests hit by cars which mysteriously career up onto the sidewalk. They are Arab women who've been raped and had acid poured on them to remove distinguishing Christian marks. And overwhelmingly, they are people who, given a moment's time, space, and freedom, live life with joy, enthusiasm, and gratitude. It's only 9 years ago that an American Jew named Michael Horowitz wrote an editorial in the Washington Post in which he said in this editorial that the new Jews of the world, he said, are the Christians. And he said there is, he felt as a Jew, what was happening to the Christians in the world today was eerily parallel to what has happened to the Jews throughout their history. What is happening to the Christians is eerily parallel to what had happened to the Jews during their history. And he raised the question. And he said, why is it the Christians in the Western world are so utterly silent about the plight that is befalling hundreds of millions of their brothers and sisters in the underdeveloped world? And secondly, why is it the Western media refuses to believe that this persecution is going on? And he answered it in terms of the media, because he said the media is run by people. Western intellectual elites are people who cannot believe there are any people in the world, save a handful of religious nutters. They cannot believe there is anyone in the world who would take the spiritual values of life so seriously that they'd be willing to die for it. And that is inconceivable to Western people raised on a diet of consumerism. That there are actually people out there whose spiritual values mean more to them than life itself. Unthinkable. But Horowitz's great question was really addressed at the Christian community. And he said, how is it that the affluent Christian churches of the Western world are so totally silent? Why are their voices not raised on behalf of their suffering brothers and sisters in the world? And that's a very, very good question. His answer, actually Horowitz's challenge has been taken up by numbers of Christian groups. The answer is so obvious. Because Christians in the West, that we've just been so utterly sucked in by the values of our society that what matters most to us is peace of mind, our own inner security, our financial security in life, and all these kind of things. And this painful stuff that's going on out there, we really don't want to know about it. Because if you see, if we believe in a gospel that is all about my inner peace of mind, and that's why we come to church, just to hear reassuring messages that can give me a greater sense of inner peace, I don't want to know about the stuff that's going on out there. Because if I knew about this and I took it seriously, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. So no one raises a voice. There's an almost deafening silence from the Western world, and a lot of people simply refuse to believe what's happening. So where's the persecution coming from? It's coming from three main sources. The first one is from a resurgent communism. Because our whole orientation to life tends to be a very European one, when communism collapsed in Europe, the feeling in the Western world was that communism is all over. It's all that horrible nightmare is finished. There was even an American wrote a book called The End of History, because that was, you know, the communists lost, the good guys won, and the history of the world is over. But do you know that one person in five in the world today lives under a communist regime? The communists still control most of East and Southeast Asia. And when communism collapsed in Eastern Europe, the Chinese authorities sent some people to investigate why this had happened, and they came back and said that one of the primary reasons they saw for the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe was the outspoken opposition of the Christian Church, because the Church in Eastern Europe was the one free agency in society. It was the only contra voice that was raised to the power of the state. And they said in this report that if we don't want this to happen in China, then we have to strangle the baby while it's still in the manger. And so apart from a few sort of showcase government churches, the church in China today is an underground movement numbering tens of millions of people. Second place the persecution is coming from is from militant Islam. Islam hasn't always been like this. When the Catholics were persecuting the Jews in the Middle Ages, the Muslims, the Jews who were being persecuted fled to Muslim countries and were accepted there. But today there's a new kind of Islamic militant who are rising, and they belong to these groups called Hezbollah and Hamas. And Islamic Jihad, and all these kind of groups. Saudi Arabia is a country that is the heart of Islam. Saudi Arabia boasts on being 100% Islamic. There are no infidels in Saudi Arabia. There are no non-Muslims. If a citizen of Saudi Arabia chooses to become a Christian, the ordinary citizens are entitled to put them to death. This sounds almost unbelievable to us, but a death sentence awaits anyone who converts from Islam. In addition, not only that, but there are a lot of expatriates in Saudi Arabia, because the Saudis have an awful lot of money. And so there's a lot of people from poorer Asian countries who've gone to work in Saudi Arabia. Now, a lot of these people who go from the Philippines and other Asian countries, and they are Christians. It is forbidden that they meet for worship in Saudi Arabia. If they're caught, they face at the very least expulsion from the country, but they face normally imprisonment, torture, and maybe even death. And there have been Filipino Christians executed in Saudi Arabia. Now, in these kind of situations, if you think about it for a moment, if you're a Saudi and you become a follower of Jesus, you know that your family members are given legal license to put you to death. If you're an expatriate, you know that you face almost certain imprisonment, possibly torture. How many people would turn up on Sundays for Christian worship? Do you know, in Saudi Arabia, there's a group called the United Churches of Saudi Arabia, which sounds a rather grandiose title. But they are a linking of 250 underground churches in Saudi Arabia. Officially, there are no Christians in Saudi Arabia. If you look in any publication, it will tell you there are no Christians. 250 house churches in Saudi Arabia of followers of Jesus who've had to go underground for the sake of their life. And the third group is a rising nationalism, because as there's the worldwide spread of globalization, a lot of nations are reacting against this and becoming very closed and very insular. And there are voices like that raised in New Zealand. You know, you've got to resist this tide of globalization. And when this happens in countries with a long religious history, often a nation closes its identity around its religion. So, for example, in India today, as India has been reacting to this, as a growing nationalism and movement in India, it's identifying very much with Hinduism. So that to be an Indian is to be a Hindu. And in Southeast Asia, it's with Buddhism. So now the situation has developed in India where militant Hindus are persecuting Christians. And this man I was quoting before, this American authority on human rights, he said that today, as we enter the 21st century, Christians around the world are now the canaries in the coal mine. You know, when they have a coal mine, they take down a canary in a cage and they hang it down in the coal mine. Because if the canary dies, you just got to get out of there. And what he's saying is that the way regimes around the world treat Christians is now the clearest indication about how much these regimes actually believe in human rights. Okay, that's all over there. This happens to other people. Some of you are not interested, because this is other people. Let me pose a question. What if something happened in New Zealand? What if there was an invasion? What if New Zealand was seized by political extremists of either the left or the right? What if New Zealand became a police state? What if you came along to church on a Sunday, and standing outside the door of the church were a couple of guys in uniforms and with big guns? And as everyone came into the church, because this is happening in the world today, as you came into the church, they're standing there with a clipboard and they're taking everybody's name and address that goes into the church. Here's the question. Would you come in? My observation is that if it rains, a quarter of us don't turn up. if there's really good programs on television on a Sunday night, there must be a good one tonight, I don't know what it is, but the numbers drop off alarmingly. If the All Blacks play overnight, the attendance at our 9 o'clock service on a Sunday morning drops off catastrophically. If these are the things that stop us from worshipping God, what would happen? There's a man in a uniform and a machine gun and he's standing there, he's taking names and addresses. Are you going to go in? Because I wouldn't be here. Because people like me are taken away by regimes like this and imprisoned and tortured. And if we renege on our faith, we're allowed back. If we're not, normally we're taken out to face the firing squad. And I know that. And I know that thousands of my colleagues in Christian ministry around the world who are pastors of churches face this as a reality every day of their lives. Would you come in? Or would you keep walking down the street? I am possessed of a great fear. Let me confess. I really wonder, in churches like this in New Zealand, if this happened to us, would anyone be here? Or a tiny handful? I really fear for this. I wonder how many of us are really deeply committed in our lives to following Jesus Christ. I mean, even if the rain can stop us from coming, fires belief, isn't it? Oh, I'm not going to worship. Nah, raining. And we've got brothers and sisters around the world who are facing the reality of torture and imprisonment and who will keep turning up at church. You know what Jesus says about this? It's amazing what he says. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Fidel Castro, in his communist regime in Cuba, arrested a Cuban poet, and they imprisoned him for 22 years in a Cuban prison. Imagine what that's like. And he wrote up his experience, and in it he writes about one Christian that he met in this prison. All of us called Geraldo, he writes, the brother of the faith. His sermons had a primitive beauty. He himself had an extraordinary magnetism. From a pulpit improvised from old salt codfish boxes covered with a sheet behind a simple cross, the thundering voice of the brother of the faith would preach his daily sermons. Then we would all sing hymns he wrote out on cigarette packages and passed out to those of us at the meeting. Many times the garrison broke up those minutes of prayer with blows and kicks, but they never managed to intimidate him. When they took him off to the forced labor fields, he organized Bible readings and choirs. Having a Bible was a subversive act, but he had, we never knew how, a little one he always carried with him. If some exhausted or sick prisoner fell behind in the furrows or hadn't piled up the amount of rock he'd been ordered to break, the brother of the faith would turn up. He was thin and wiry with incredible stamina for physical labor. He would catch the other man up in his work, save him from brutal beatings. When one of the guards would walk up behind him and hit him, the brother of the faith would spring erect, look into the guard's eyes and say to him, "May God pardon you." In the midst of that apocalyptic vision of the most dreadful and horrifying moments in my life, in the midst of the grey, ashy dust and the orgy of beatings and blood, prisoners beaten to the ground, a man emerged, the skeletal figure of a man wasted by hunger, with white hair, blazing blue eyes, and a heart overflowing with love, raising his arms to the invisible heaven and pleading for his executioners. "Forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do." And a burst of machine gun fire ripping open his chest. "Rejoice and be glad," Jesus said, "for so persecuted they the prophets who were before you, and great is your reward in heaven." I heard a story about an American missionary. He'd gone to Africa. He'd spent his whole adult life in Africa. He'd buried his wife and his children who got malaria. He was the only surviving member of his family. And as an old man, he went back to America. And it just happened to be at the end of the Second World War, and it just happened that he flew back to America on the same flight that took Dwight Eisenhower back. And the flight landed in New York. And the bands were there, and the red carpet, and the big banners, "Welcome home, Ike." Thousands of people. Confetti going around, all this kind of stuff. He got off the plane a long time after Eisenhower, of course, and saw what was going on. He stood there and he said he was just overwhelmed with a sense of failure. He thought, what if I'd gone somewhere and made a name for myself? People could have been out welcoming me home. I'm coming home by myself. There's no one here to meet me. No one knows I'm coming. My family lie buried in the ground in Africa. And he said it was like he heard a voice whispering in his ear, "My son," God said to him, "my son, but you're not home yet. And rejoice and be glad," Jesus said, "for so persecuted they the prophets, and great is your reward in heaven." I don't think heaven is very real for most of us who live in countries like New Zealand. Who needs heaven when you've got a welfare state and consumer goods and all this kind of stuff? But if you live in a place where your very life is at risk, where your commitment to your faith could mean your life would be taken. People like this live in the reality of another world and know that death isn't the finish, but the opening of the door to paradise. What can you do about it? I did some sums yesterday, and I've figured out that by the middle of next year, if you count up men, women, and children who are going to be serving Jesus overseas, over 90% of them are going to be working in countries where people are persecuted for their faith, where Christians are persecuted for their faith. Do you know what this means? It means every single one of us has the incredible privilege of standing with these people. Some of you may have read an article in the press on Friday about the Taliban who rule Afghanistan. It was a backgrounder to what's going on that Norwegian ship. It was a very good article. And it talked about these 2.5 to 3 million refugees who've escaped from Afghanistan. And most of them have escaped to Pakistan. And in Pakistan, there are these huge refugee camps. And the center of them is in a place called Peshawar. And by the middle of next year, we will have two families from this church who will be living in Peshawar and who will be ministering the love of Jesus to these Muslims, mostly Muslims, who fled from this tyrannical Muslim regime that is running the country, their country. Almost all of them who turn up in the camps will have had family members machine gunned to death. Many of them will have lost family members on the trek over the mountains to get to Pakistan. And you know, two families from this church, two couples from this church, will be there in Peshawar to meet them when they come and to stand alongside them. You know, this is a matter of life and death. And what an incredible privilege to be a follower of Jesus and to belong to a church that is really seriously trying to understand what is God doing in this world, that it isn't all just about materialism and consumer goods and my personal comfort, but to be a follower of Jesus means that I can stand with the broken and the persecuted and the suffering of the world, and we can make a difference. For every terrified Afghani citizen that comes seeking help, there'll be some people from our church who could be there. You know, this matters. I want to conclude this morning, just this evening, just reading a passage. Jesus is talking about the end of the world. And he's talking about the final judgment when all the nations of the world will be gathered before God. And this is what he says in Matthew 25. When the Son of Man comes as king and all the angels with him, he will sit on his royal throne and the people of all the nations will be gathered before him. Then he will divide them into two groups, just as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the righteous people on his right and the others on his left. Then the king will say to the people on his right, come you that are blessed by my Father, come and possess the kingdom which has been prepared for you ever since the creation of the world. I was hungry and you fed me, thirsty and you gave me a drink. I was a stranger and you received me in your homes, naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you took care of me, in prison and you visited me. The righteous will answer him, when, Lord, did we ever see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you a drink? When did we ever see you a stranger and welcome you in our homes, or naked and clothe you? When did we ever see you sick or in prison and visit you? The king will reply, I tell you, whenever you did this for one of the least important of these followers of mine, you did it for me. Jesus said that the persecuted are blessed by God. And he tells us here that inasmuch as we care for the persecuted, the hungry, the naked, the homeless among his followers, we're doing it for him. What's your response going to be to that? Let's bow our heads in prayer. Martin Luther King once said, no one really knows why they're alive until they know what they'd die for. Maybe just in the quietness you might ask yourself, do I have anything to die for? Do I have anything in life that is more important to me than myself? My immediate needs? Would I die for that? Some of us tonight would never have actually begun a journey of following Jesus. And you may like to take this time just in your own heart to respond to him. Others of us would profess to be his followers, but have never really allowed our lives to be shaped by the love of God so that we are actively standing with the persecuted of the earth and demonstrating the love of Jesus. Forgive us, Lord. We are so affluent. We are so much at ease. And help us, O God, in the midst of our affluence and our ease, to catch even just a tiny little bit of your heartbeat for the destitute of the earth and those who are persecuted for your sake. We ask it in your name, Lord Jesus. Amen.